What is crack-a-lackin', fellow thermonuclear AFers? I am Dan Pavalli coming at you with a solo podcast. Before we get started, the usual reminder, please remember to subscribe to us if you haven't done so already. Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, Google, wherever you get your podcasts. Also, hit that subscribe button on YouTube. Like, comment, help the algorithm love us back. If you have done all those things, we ask that you tell people about us. Spread the word. Tell your friends, family members, acquaintances, random people on the street, enemies, social media people. Shout us out on Twitter. Retweet us on Twitter. Quote something we said on the podcast on Twitter. Anything you can do to help spread the word about what is just a certified fantabulous podcast, in my totally unbiased opinion, would mean the absolute world. Let's dive in here. A lot to get to. I want to start with the Dallas Mavericks. And the question became entering Monday. Should the Dallas Mavericks tank, which is a fascinating question for a team that has Luka Doncic and Kyrie Irving, that was coming on the heels of two straight losses to the Hornets. They did beat the Indiana Pacers rather handedly on Monday night, so that sort of quells some of the concerns. They got a really big bump from the league. They rescinded Luka Doncic's 16th technical, so it allowed him to play against the Pacers on Monday night. He had one of the most wicked passes I've ever seen in my entire life. Go back and watch that if you haven't already. And so this question of should the Dallas Mavericks tank coincides with are the Dallas Mavericks fucked? Was the Kyrie Irving trade a mistake? The Kyrie Irving trade itself is still to be determined. When you look at where the Mavericks are, and yes, it's not flattering. They are 4-8 in games that him and Luka Doncic have played together. When you look at the Mavs since the trade, and this will include some times that he has not played, some games that Luka Doncic has not played. And look, that's part of it. Doncic missed time. He hasn't always looked right. Coming back from injury, Kyrie Irving dealing with some foot stuff. He has not looked right in recent games. The Mavs have the eighth best offense, though, since the Kyrie Irving trade. But they're 21st in defense, which, look, I'm not going to lie, that's actually higher than I thought it was going to be. When you watch this team, it feels like they can't get stops, more so than even the Kings. But their transition defense has actually been, like, not totally crappy. They've had more issues when you're looking at second chance opportunities and then just protecting the basket in general. Opponents are shooting over 71% against the rim since the Kyrie Irving trade. That is one of the four worst marks in the league. These were when you, and also let's dig into the data on the Kyrie Luka Doncic minutes. The Mavs are winning those minutes still, plus about 4 points per 100 possessions. 121 offensive rating. The defense has been bad, though. And with those two on the court, the transition defense is a problem, which is not surprising because Luka Doncic is always complaining to the referees. It's what you would expect, though. And you look at the rim protection, it's bad. The ball containment is bad. This is what happens when you trade your best defender to get Kyrie Irving, who is not, I mean, like, on his best nights, I think you could say that maybe he's an upgrade over probably not Jalen Brunson, but an upgrade over what Spencer Dinwiddie was doing this season. Maybe not what Spencer Dinwiddie was doing last season. Reggie Bullock, though, is not the same compared to last year. You're leaning a lot on Josh Green here. Jaden Harvey, been standout, but he's also a rookie. You're integrating Tim Hardaway Jr. back into the rotation, and he is still a defensive negative. Maxi Kleba, probably now your best defender. Is it him or Josh Green? I don't really know. It might even be Reggie Bullock. He has not looked right since he came back from his own hamstring injury that he had surgery on. And then you're still playing the JaVale McGee's just a non-entity at this point. You're still playing Christian Wood, and he's had some, I think, higher defensive moments than I would have thought. Doesn't feel like, from what I've caught of the Mavs so much lately. You're playing Justin Holiday, who wasn't even part of the Atlanta Hawks rotation. These are issues. Some of them are symptoms of the Kyrie Irving trade. You're not going to maybe go out. Maybe you probably still go out and get Justin Holiday, but you're not as reliant on some of these other guys if Dorian Finney-Smith is still here. But the Maxi Kleba stuff, the rim protection stuff, that was all an issue before Kyrie Irving came here. And so I don't, as much as everyone who listens to this podcast knows how I feel about Kyrie Irving, you can't lay all of this at his feet, especially when all the reporting has been from Mark Stein, from Tim McMahon. I think even Tim Cato over The Athletic has said this, that Kyrie Irving is well-liked amongst his teammates. And I think when you talk to players around the league, most of them tend to really like Kyrie, even the players who are on teams that he kind of submarined. Look at the Cavs and how LeBron James clearly feels about Kyrie now. That Boston team, I think Jaylen Brown has actually come out in defense of Kyrie at one point. I don't want to misspeak there, so I could be wrong. Maybe the teams he's played for, they have these more complicated feelings towards him, the players that are still there. But it does seem that Kyrie Irving's teammates, like at least in Dallas, let's forget about all the other places, Boston, Cleveland, Brooklyn. Is there weird stuff going on with him and Kevin Durant? He clearly rankled James Harden the wrong way. So I'm not calling him the best teammate in NBA history, but it does seem like he's been, I believe this was coined by, was it Mark Stein, the consummate professional since he's been in Dallas. I think he's handled most of his media availability really well. He said some dumb shit still. I think like saying that the fans, if they're going to boo, they should come out and do a better job on the floor or whatever. That was just mind-meltingly stupid. But again, you look at the Mavs' struggles and it's the same things, maybe on a higher scale because you made the trade in the first place, but Kyrie wasn't going to come in and fix your defense. He was going to help you have that second shot creator when you all, while replacing the other second shot creator that you had in Spencer Dinwiddie, you were already at a shot creation deficit because of Jalen Brunson leaving. And we don't need to belabor that. That is part of this though, too. This is not just about the Kyrie Irving trade. This isn't Kyrie Irving comes in, the Mavs all of a sudden suck something awful. Are they worse than I would have expected since the Kyrie Irving trade? Yes. Although I would actually argue, and this, some of this probably has to do with their opponents and the games they've played, Luka Doncic missing some time. Their defense overall has just been a little bit better than I've expected. When you just go in and dig into the numbers, when you watch it, it doesn't feel that way. That problem is not going away this season. And the Mavs, you might think that they're dangerous if they get in a playoff series because we know Luka Doncic has been lights out in the playoffs. And absolutely, sometimes he looks gas when he's there. Now he has Kyrie Irving. Maybe they'll work through some of the offensive warts that we've seen, which again, the numbers don't always show it, but like Kyrie Irving kind of standing in the corner when he doesn't have the ball, that's not something that's going to make your offense maximized in the playoffs. It's not going to optimize you, certainly. It will make you easier to defend against better defenses that have time to game plan around you in between, in between games, because they're going to have at least a day off and they're not facing other opponents in the interim there. So the Mavs are not contenders this season. Like they're at this point, yeah, you would expect them to make the Western Conference play-in. They're not guaranteed to anymore. And they are, as I record this, in 11th place. So they wouldn't be in the play-in right now. You're banking on them usurping. The Jazz will do what they can to not make the playoffs, but you're banking on them usurping one of the Thunder, the Lakers, maybe the Pelicans. I would say the Warriors and the Timberwolves and Clippers, those are teams that feel out of reach. So why not tank? Keep your top 10 draft pick this year. They owe it to the Knicks. And then you would be able to trade said draft pick, theoretically, after you actually select the player, and trying and fix some of the issues that you have now. That really just doesn't make sense to me. Aside from the messaging that you're sending to Luka Doncic by doing that, you actually don't have a ton of time with Kyrie Irving before he hits free agency. You can assume just because the Mavs can offer him the most money over the most years that they are the favorites to keep him. And I think that's a fair way to go. Otherwise, Kyrie Irving would not have forced to trade away from Brooklyn. But I don't know that we can also pretend to know what Kyrie Irving is thinking or which way that he is leaning. And maybe the Mavs just, if they won't even give him a full max and he just decides, you know what, then I'm just going to take a pay cut, sign for $25 million with the Lakers since they decided to go with the cap space route, which I don't ultimately think they'll do. That's just one example. Aside from that, just the chances here, when you look at the records in the NBA, and like we are now for the Mavericks specifically, we're 73 games into the season. So the time to do this wasn't, 73, isn't it more? Is it 76 for them? I'm all over the place right now. Yeah, so we're 76 games into the season for the Dallas Mavericks. This is not like the time to just turn around and tank. They can realistically go from, like, look at the teams that are worse than them, the Bulls and the Jazz behind the standings. They could probably catch them if they really tank their asses off to have what would be one of the, it'd be the ninth worst record in the NBA. You're not going to get to the Pistons, the Rockets, the Spurs, the Hornets. Those are the bottom four records. The Blazers, they've thrown in the towel a while ago, it looked like, and the Magic, that's going to be your fifth and sixth worst team. The Pacers even, and the Wizards. So like those to me are just going to be the teams that have the eight worst records. Maybe the Jazz could catch one of them, but if you're the Mavericks, you have 39 losses. The Bulls have 38 losses. The Jazz have 40 losses. You can catch them. That's the difference of, as of right now, if you finished where you were, you don't make the play-in, you're going to have a 9.4% chance of getting a top four pick. If you get to, you know, pass, if you out-tank Washington and Chicago, you're going to have like a 20.2% chance. So you more than double your odds, and maybe you view that as worth it in this draft, but like, okay, cool. And I guess you could say, well, if they finish with the ninth worst record, that means that they get to keep their draft pick. That's fine. But you might just want to get that draft conveyance out of the way, because who you really, how valuable is that ninth pick as a trade? Let's just say it's the ninth pick. How valuable is that ninth pick as a trade asset this season, off season? I think teams would be more interested in probably distant Mavericks first round picks, which you've already given one away, the 2029 first in that Kyrie Irving trade. So if you all of a sudden have to kick the can on that Knicks pick to 2024, you cannot trade a first round pick until 2026. And so you can only trade your 2026 or 2027 first round picks at that point. You can also trade your 2023 first after you use it on them. So like that puts you in a, or you could still trade your 2023 first round pick, whatever. That's not as enticing if you go 2023 and 26, 27 versus, oh, we can trade 24 and 26 right now. Like that is something you could do, or you could trade 25 and 27 to go with, along with 2029 that's out there to the Knicks. You can trade two first round picks this summer plus other stuff, which you have Josh Green, you have Jaden Harvey. I don't know that, I shouldn't say I don't know. Those are not going to be considered blue chip assets, but they're not nothing either. And so there are moves that you could still make, which is the other part of this for me. I don't think the Mavs are in this enviable position, but they have Luka Doncic, they have Kyrie Irving, and you can still go out when you look at the salary matching tools they have. Reggie Bullock, he has half his salary next year is guaranteed. So let's just view him as a $10.5 million expiring contract. At that point, you're only going to have, you know, Maxi Kleber might still be viewed as an asset. He'll have 3 years at $33 million left on his deal as that extension kicks in. You could use JaVale McGee. He has 2 years left on his deal. Like teams might be willing to swallow that money. You also have Tim Hardaway Jr. will have 2 years left on his deal. Davis Bertans will have 2 years left on his deal. So you're kind of light on actual expiring contracts, but you have digestible salaries that are short-term obligations that aren't going to go past 2024, 2025, that you can then attach to those two first-round picks, which, hey, teams might be interested in because of the combustibility you're already showing right now. Do I think that the Mavs would end up having the best offer for an OG Anunoby, let's say, or Mikal Bridges? I honestly don't know. Let's just say they go as high as two unprotected picks, and then you're willing to give Josh Green and Jaden Hardy. I think it would be one of the more competitive offers. It's not certainly not for a superstar level, but for those types of players, maybe they're even willing to include some swaps there. That matters. And this isn't, they're not incapable of upgrading this roster. People are treating it like they've bankrupted all their assets. Again, I would not have made the Kyrie Irving trade, but this talk that the Mavs have no way out right now, it's too premature. Now, it becomes disastrous if you lose Kyrie Irving in free agency, but the market for him is, I would imagine it's going to be fairly sparse. Like, I don't even think the Lakers are going to act as a cap space team. Even if they're willing to go the sign and trade route, it's almost impossible to fit Kyrie Irving under the hard cap with LeBron and AD salary on the books. Where else is he going? And so I think even if he does leave, you're probably going to go the sign and trade route anyway. So hopefully you would get something in return for him. That's the disaster scenario. But guess what? That hasn't played out yet. Like, we don't know what Kyrie Irving is going to do. And I think it's fair to say, as I said at the top of this, that the Mavs are overwhelming favorites to re-sign him. I wouldn't, again, pretend to know what Kyrie Irving is thinking, but just the way he forced his way out of Brooklyn and the logistics of the situation and the cap space climate. So many of the teams that have it are sort of in the early stages of a rebuild, or they're the Rockets and they're going to chase James Harden. So that disaster scenario is not played out just yet. And if, as we expect, Kyrie Irving comes back, yeah, the roster's still facing the same issues. There are one things you could do on the cheap to probably address rim protection. Go after a Bismack Biyombo. Someone like that would go a long way towards helping this team. You could take flyers on defense first guys on the perimeter, or just cheaper back end rotation players for other teams, like a Javonte Green would really help this roster. You can go that route and you can still make trades. You're still going to have your mini mid-level exception. I don't know who you can get for that. It seems like Bruce Brown and Matisse Thybulle have both played their way out of that price tier. Matisse Thybulle being a restricted free agent also makes it super difficult. I don't know if Hamidou Diallo does enough for this roster, but you have your mini mid-level exception. That certainly can get you an upgrade on the big man front. And then you can go out and trade, I would argue, for at least one other perimeter defender. And maybe you break it up into two separate trades where it's, well, we're not going to consolidate into, and I'm just, let's say OG Anunoby is an option. He would be perfect for this team, as would Mikal Bridges. I think OG would probably make more sense just because the Mavs don't need the shot creation as much, which Mikal Bridges would bring you. They need the defensive range up front more. And I think OG would bring you more of that. But let's just say you can get OG Anunoby. You don't have to go that route. You can kind of take it down a peg and do something like, okay, well, do we get a Royce O'Neal from Brooklyn? I'm not saying Brooklyn would help. I'm not saying that Brooklyn would help the Mavs out by trading Nick Claxton or Royce O'Neal then, but like you can go after Royce O'Neal level players and try and just execute two separate trades on that front. You don't want to be net negative two first round picks in that scenario per se. And there are probably names here that none of us are certainly considering because we need to see how the trade market actually shapes out. And like I said before, if there is a star that becomes available, no, Dallas isn't going to have the best bid. But if you're going after a guy like Alex Caruso, that might not cost you two first-round picks. Just at the time he'll be in his deal and what direction are the Cavs going in at that point. Presumably you want a bigger wing defender if you're going to consolidate. So no, from the Mavs, are not giving up two first-round picks for Alex Caruso. But those are names that they actually have the assets to go out and get. I would think they could be in the OG Anunoby business. Like maybe I'm overstating there. What does it cost to get Jay Sean Tate out of Houston? He's been so banged up this year. He's banged up right now. The Rockets are kind of all over the place. They have Tari Eason there. KJ Martin's had a good year. They have Jabari Smith Jr. Are they willing to, move Jay Sean Tate without even giving up a first round pick? That's the route you could go. You have enough offense to where it's like, he can kind of put the ball on the floor and attack the basket. If his three's not falling, that's absolutely fine. So they are not without options, and they definitely should not tank this season. I'm not bullish on their future, but I do think we've kind of swung too far in the wrong direction. Both of these things could be true. The Mavericks have fucked up repeatedly, and what's happening now is not the result of the Kyrie Irving trade so much as the process that led them here, which was just misstep after misstep. And they can also still have hope. Like, they're not dead yet. This season, yeah, it's over. I'm sorry. Like, I don't know what first-round opponent. I guess if it's the Grizzlies, like, if you're going to go into a matchup with the Grizzlies, I might feel okay about picking Dallas in that, but I don't think there's a first-round series they're going to have where I would pick them anyway. So this season, yeah, it's dead, it's done, but their future is not overwhelmingly bleak. I wouldn't say that they're in an enviable position. I think I already said it at the top of the podcast, but there is still hope here, and I think we need to remember that the Kyrie Irving trade is not the disease here. It's a symptom of the disease that is the Dallas Mavericks team-building process. Let's get to some bold predictions for the rest of the season that I came up with. And the goal here, I did this, Bleacher Report asked me to do this, so I'm going to relay it to you guys here to see what you think. The goal here is just me gauging the tenor of what's left of the season, what we've seen so far, what's happening right now, and deciding, hey, these thoughts go against consensus, but I kind of believe them to be true enough that I'm throwing them out here. I will say that I try to go with more than 50% conviction on them. One of these, and I'll start off with that one, I'm kind of waffling on whether I have 50% conviction on, but let's start this off. Again, we'll see how wrong I am. I did this exercise, I think, a month ago, and I feel pretty good still about half. I said Damian Lillard was going to make first team All-NBA. I no longer think that after he gets shut down. It's not out after he got shut down, not outside the realm of possibility, but it's not something that I feel just particularly bullish on anymore. So thought this would still be a fun exercise. My first one, bold prediction number one, Jaylen Brown will make an All-NBA team and become Supermax eligible. This is a big deal. He has a lot of money riding on the All-NBA rosters. If he makes an All-NBA team, he will be eligible to sign a 4-year Supermax extension worth a hair under $218 million. Forget about that number. Merely having the ability to sign that deal would go a long way towards clarifying his future with the Celtics. At the moment, there's not too much cause to fret over his ambiguous comments. Without a first career All-NBA nod, he can only put pen to paper on an extension that nets him 120% raise. It makes all the financial sense in the world for him to hit free agency in 2024 and not sign an extension. That calculus changes with Supermax eligibility. If he doesn't sign any sort of extension, or if the Celtics don't offer one, then Bostonians can start sweating it out. And also, Brian Toporek recently wrote about this for Forbes. The extension parameters might change in the new CBA. They're talking about maybe allowing 150% raises in extensions. I don't know. That still wouldn't bring Brown to what his max could be, but it would certainly help the cause. For now, though, Brown is better off prepping for free agency without his Supermax eligibility. Whether he gets the opportunity to be Supermax eligible is what we're debating here. He needs to get to that All-NBA roster first. He'll be eligible at both guard and forward. It's not happening as a guard. The pool of candidates is just too saturated. You have Steph Curry, Luka Doncic, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, and Damian Lillard. I would argue those are all locks to take four of the spots. Then you have De'Aaron Fox, Donovan Mitchell, Ja Morant, Devin Booker, and James Harden, among some other guys who will vie for those final two slots. Brown, though, again, he's played most of his minutes at the three per Clean the Glass this year, and he's going to be eligible at forward. Giannis and Jason Tatum are probably the only two forwards I would pencil in as locks. You could, building it out from there, you could include other locks. Jimmy Butler, does he belong there? But there are extensive absences from Kevin Durant, LeBron James, and Kawhi Leonard. That was from the beginning of the year that help open things up. All three of those guys, by the way, are on track to fall outside the top 125 in total minutes played. Each of them could grab an All-NBA spot, in my opinion. None of them could grab it. Someone like Zion Williamson, already out of the running. Those repressed cases are really going to help out Jaylen Brown's path to All-NBA. They won't guarantee it, though. Like I said, Jimmy Butler, he might be close to a lock at this point. You have Pascal Siakam, Lauri Markkanen, Julius Randle. All those guys are going to want a word. The other thing we have to account for here, which is why I'm not super confident in this one, what if the NBA does its typical fudging the positional eligibility thing, where let's say Anthony Davis and Domas Sabonis are allowed to be voted in as forwards because they want, or Bam Adebayo, just because we've seen it before with Jokic and Bede being eligible as forwards, and they're clearly not forwards this year. I don't know how that's going to work. There isn't going to be as big enough of a push. I think you look and there's, again, it's four centers that could contend for it in theory. I guess five, throwing Davis, Bam Adebayo, Domas Sabonis, Joel Embiid, and Jokic. And so if two of those guys are eligible at forward, and it helps you fit all of them in on an All-NBA team, that would theoretically hurt Brown's chances. At the same time, like, Brown is averaging basically 27 points, 3 assists, a steal a game, downing over 57% of his twos. His three-point clip has dipped a little bit, but he is connecting on almost 47% of his off-the-dribble two-point jumpers. That's big. It's also the second highest mark of his career, and he's never averaged more free throw attempts per 36 minutes. I think we also need to account his defensive responsibilities scale higher than pretty much anyone else he's battling. You know, when you're looking at, okay, Kawhi, no, but, and Jimmy Butler, no, but Pascal Siakam, Julius Randle, Lauri Markkanen, Kevin Durant, LeBron James, even if you want to throw Sabonis in there, not Bam or Davis, forget their centers. Let's forget those guys for now. So that has to matter too. And Marcus Smart per B-ball index is the only Celtics player that has spent more time guarding number one and number two options. Ultimately, there's still too much season left for me to say, I believe with every fiber of my being, Jaylen Brown will make an All-NBA team. But I think his candidacy is convincing enough to roll the dice, especially if you think, as I do, that voters will favor players who are, one, extremely available, like Brown has been, and have extension money on the line. And so I think we could see, I don't want to say an overinflation of support for Jaylen Brown, Ja Morant, but I think that those guys might receive more support than we collectively may initially believe when media members know that they have all this extension money on the line. Let's move on to bold prediction number two. I have this. It's going to be wildly unpopular. The Memphis Grizzlies will lose in the first round of the playoffs. Matchups stand to dictate the fate of the entire 2023 Western Conference playoffs. The landscape is either gloriously chaotic or sweepingly unspectacular, or some combination of both. That waters down the spiciness of me forecasting any first round exit. There's some extra heat here, though, when I'm making it before the postseason lineup gets set and when said team is on a streak. Enter my distrust of the Memphis Grizzlies. They're really good, and they're about to, in all likelihood, finish with the West's second best record. They've managed to put some distance between themselves and the Sacramento Kings, despite navigating absences from Steven Adams, Brandon Clark, and Ja Morant. Their defense is as advertised. It's absolute hellfire. Jaren Jackson Jr. would probably be the runaway favorite for Defensive Player of the Year if his minutes per game were higher, and he still might be the runaway favorite anyway. The Grizzlies, as a whole, are just in your face. They defend like controlled anarchy. They're all over the place, and finding weak points to target in their defense can be tough, even when Morant is on the floor this season, even this side of the Luke Kennard trade. That still doesn't mean we have to trust them, and I don't. The offense to me, doesn't seem playoff proof. They're hovering around the bottom 10 in three-point attempt rate. They're hovering around the bottom 5 in three-point accuracy. They are hovering around the bottom 5 in catch-and-shoot effective field goal percentage. And they are in the bottom 10 in overall half-court efficiency. That heavy dependence on second-chance opportunities and transition frequency is not easily translatable to the postseason. We saw that even as they put up a fight against the Golden State Warriors last year. Memphis is going to be even harder pressed to sustain its offensive rebounding presence if Steven Adams isn't ready to rock. We also know Brandon Clark is out for the season. The Grizzlies have struggled on the glass ever since Adams went down with that right knee injury. I will say, this is cause for pause. The Grizzlies are hovering around the top 5 in half-court offense since the All-Star break without an over-reliance on second-chance points. That is incredible. It also doesn't infer a new normal. Dylan Brooks has been shooting well from 3. That won't last. The team has been shooting like 50% on long mid-range jumpers. That won't last. Luke Kennard has been good for them offensively, but his minutes, I think, will get harder to survive in the playoffs. I also, is Tyus Jones going to continue playing like this into the postseason? Yeah, he's a starting caliber point guard, but is he going to flame throw at this level? These Grizzlies still have the same flaws that they did last year, and I think that's going to make them even more exploitable once they get into the playoffs. Internal leaps from Jaren Jackson Jr. and Desmond Bane help, but the roster, again, projects to be more shorthanded overall. You're not going to rely on Zaire Williams for every minute, and you're going to be without Brandon Clark, and then who knows what Steven Adams is what his availability is going to look like. This then raises a question for me, and for all of us, I would think. Who, beyond the faintest shadow of a doubt, do you trust the Grizzlies to beat in the first round? Dallas, Minnesota, Golden State, Lakers, Clippers, those are all teams that they could beat, that they might even be favored against, but they're not teams that you can just outright trust them to beat. I guess Dallas would come closest here. The optimism is going to bleed through if you wind up facing Utah, New Orleans, or Oklahoma City. My counterpoint would be, would it? Utah is not going to make the playoffs, or just whatever, and so they don't matter here. What if the Pelicans get Zion Williamson back? Their defense has also just been playing better of late, and they've done a better job incorporating Jonas Valanciunas on offense. Or if, so they could be this version of the Pelicans. They could have the version of the Pelicans with Zion back. They would be scary. Underestimate the Thunder at your own risk. They sort of feel a little too happy to be here right now, but they're a team that has improved a great deal on offense. They would have... They would have the best player in that series this season in Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. And they just have a lot of different options they could throw at you defensively as well. Again, Memphis would be favored in, I don't want to say majority of these series, but a good handful of them. I just don't think we can trust them to beat anyone that I really just named. If it was the Jazz, sure. If you want to say New Orleans and Oklahoma City, sure. But if it ends up being Dallas, Minnesota, Golden State, Lakers, Clippers, things get really weird there. So yes, Memphis could definitely still make it out of the first round. They should probably even be favored to make it out of the first round. That's sort of the whole point of the exercise that I'm doing, though. These predictions are not givens. I have the Grizzlies losing in the first round of playoffs. Grizzlies fans should probably thank me later because I'm just so constantly wrong about them. It's almost impressive. My bold prediction number 3, the Bulls will make the playoffs. This is bold because 538 gives them like a 30% chance of making the playoffs right now. It's also bold if you watch them just get, well, I started recording this before it was over, but if you watch them get trounced by the LA Clippers on Monday night. I'm trying to sit here straight-faced and continue to make this prediction about the 10th place team in the East, that they're going to win the play-in tournament and make the postseason. At the same time, I also can't pretend to understand what's happening in Oklahoma City. The Bulls are over 500 since the All-Star break with the top 3 defense and top 6 net rating. Their 44-point shellacking of Brooklyn on February 24th inflates those returns, but they're still 11th in defense when you pull that one out, and with a comfortably positive point differential per 100 possessions. And you could also say, look, Chicago had that own blowout loss to the Sixers on, what was it, March 22nd, who they actually beat on March 20th, by the way. They did beat the Sixers. That also skews their returns in the wrong direction. So that, in theory, would balance it out. I don't know whether you could believe in this late-season revival. I, myself, am oozing skepticism. I'm not going to dismiss it either. The Bulls aren't going to can 38-plus percent of their threes until the end of time. The roster's not built for it. But it's also not like they're suddenly taking a ton more threes, nor is anyone playing especially over their head. They've had a deal with DeMar DeRozan's banged up quad. They've had to deal with absences from Alex Caruso. But like, it's so they're not really even being helped there. And the backup big man rotation is still sort of a mess. But Zach LaVine is torching defenses from every level. That's not unheard of. DeMar DeRozan continues to be DeRozan, even as he's playing through that quad injury. Patrick Williams' efficiency has been off the charts, and yet they're still dealing with the same ultra-low volume issues. And they run into those same issues with Patrick Beverley and Alex Caruso, too. Kobe White's bandwagon is a little more crowded during the stretch. It has not filled up beyond reason. Nikola Vucevic is doing most of his damage outside the jump shot arena, or at least the three-point arena. The defensive success, when you look at it, it feels like an anomaly, but then it's sort of like, okay, maybe not. It would be a season-long one then. Chicago does seem to be getting lucky on opponent shooting from close range and at the foul line, but they're not getting overly fortunate anywhere else. And the exterior defense remains stacked with these lively pests who contest everything, get inside jerseys, take charges, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Emotionally invest yourself in the peskier Bulls with a metric ton of salt. When you're scaling ahead, they should still probably rebuild over the offseason. They shouldn't double down on this core. Don't financially invest in them either by any stretch. Don't predict for them to make it out of the first round, to make it to the Eastern Conference Finals or whatever. But I'm not presupposing that Chicago will win a first-round playoff series against Milwaukee, Boston, or Philly. I'm just saying they will get there. And I think when you look at the play-in field right now, this says more perhaps about my distrust in Brooklyn, Atlanta, and Toronto than it does about my trust in Chicago. I still think if you're going to put those four teams together, to say that Chicago is the one that survives, and I'm just saying Miami won't be the team that makes the play-in here now, so I am making a little bit of a prediction there. I don't think it's unruly, but it is statistically a bit of a long shot. Bold prediction number four. This one leaks into the offseason. It's going to be an unpopular one, especially amongst Herb Jones enjoyer in Discord. I think New Orleans is going to break up the big three over the offseason. Optimism is definitely running a little higher around the Pelicans. They're on a five-game winning streak. They beat the Clippers on Saturday night. That's a big one. But they also, you know, I'm not going to throw confetti for them beating the Spurs, the Rockets, this version of the Blazers. Still, in their defense, the offense seems to have remembered that Jonas Valanciunas exists over the past week or so. The defense is seventh in points allowed per possession since the All-Star break. And while Zion isn't definitely coming back, he's not coming back either. That's basically the updates we keep getting. I can't believe in the recent surge. It's not that they have the talent, but I don't know that they're ever going to piece it together at the same time. Pretty much everything unraveled after the Zion injury. New Orleans is now 13, even after this winning streak, they're now 15 and 23 during that time, with almost a bottom five offense and a shot profile that's begging for more threes and rim pressure. Brandon Ingram did miss a huge chunk of this stretch himself, but his return has not represented this singular solve. The Pelicans are getting spanked when he and CJ McCollum play without Zion, while living and dying, far too extensively from the mid-range. Expecting New Orleans to break up its big three, which is basically just a way of saying they will trade Ingram or McCollum, might seem like an overreaction. I, of course, the Pelicans aren't great. Zion has yet again missed most of the season. How good are they supposed to be? My issue is it's better than this. The Pelicans need to do a better job reworking their core, both in and outside Zion's image. Surrounding him with more high-volume snipers and a rim-protecting center is a must. His general transcendence can paper over a lot of other issues. New Orleans, though, cannot count on him being available enough for that to make a difference. And so when you're reorienting the core around him, it's not that you're trying to plan for the worst case scenario so much as reacting to life as you know it. With and without him, the Pelicans need a better offensive organizer who has a more consistent presence from deep or at the basket. There's a little too much overlap in both the individual strengths and weaknesses of McCollum and Ingram to fancy New Orleans a finished product near the top. Again, it would be different if you were to say Zion's going to play in 60 games every season. You don't get to say that. We have these 4 years worth of evidence to back up that that's not going to happen at this point. I think the counter here would be the Pelicans can absolutely shake up the base of its rotation without moving McCollum or Ingram. They have future first-round picks and prospect equity to cobble together competitive offers independent of both those players. But this prediction indulges an increasingly strong inkling that New Orleans needs a better second or third best player to optimize its window with Zion and will be prepared, if not forced, to act on it. And the final thing to consider there would be, let's say they can pull off a blockbuster trade or two, a big trade. And I'm not, maybe they decide not to pull off a big trade. That would be a mistake if they don't reorient the core in some fashion. They can keep Ingram and McCollum. It's what I would do. Here's the issue, though, is you get to a point where matching salary is harder to come by. You have Larry Nance's money, Jonas Valanciunas's money, and that's like kind of the biggest salary numbers that you could use if you're not going to move a Zion, McCollum or an Ingram there. And you also have to start worrying about, because you're going to have Zion's max extension kicking in, about paying the tax. The Pelicans have said they would pay the tax for the right team. So many teams say that. So many teams say that. And so if you're tacking on someone with a big salary, and maybe, look, you're even trying to keep Jackson Hayes, who's going to be a restricted free agent. Are you looking at bringing back Josh Richardson? As of right now, if they renounce Jackson Hayes and they don't bring back Josh Richardson, they're still going to be, they won't be in the tax, but they're going to be like fairly close to the tax. Maybe they'll have within $7 million in the tax, is where the spreadsheet I'm looking at has them within $8 million, really. That's less than the non-taxpayer's mid-level exception. So if you use the non-taxpayer's mid-level, you'd be committing to going into the tax there. If you're taking on a bigger number than just an $11 million player, if you're trying to turn, you know, Larry Nance Jr. and Jonas Valanciunas into a more expensive player, you're going to be willing to enter the tax next season or the season after that. That comes into play, which is why looking at moving a McCollum or an Ingram might be viewed as financially prudent within the Pelicans front office or among ownership. I wouldn't support it, but that's just my gut feeling here, is that McCollum or Ingram will be traded over the offseason. If they keep playing like this, or Zion comes back and they just rip off a deep playoff push, then it probably won't happen. And again, I'm not rooting for it to happen. I would love to see this team, as currently constructed, add some rim protection, some shooting, and then go into next season. But the Zion health bugaboo hanging over all of this just leads me to believe that we might see something a little bit more seismic than most people are counting on as we head into the offseason. Let's see if I'm wrong. My fifth and final bold prediction: Shai Gilgeous-Alexander will finish sixth in MVP. Top six of MVP voting, to leave open the door that he could finish in the top five still, which that would be a real bold prediction. Those who own residential real estate on the edge are free to bump this up to that top five finish. I came pretty close to going there myself when I was doing this exercise. It's a little too bold for my taste. SGA is not going to surpass Giannis, Joel Embiid, or Nikola Jokic. And then leapfrogging even one of Luka Doncic or Jason Tatum at this point feels like a stretch. I think you could make a case for it right now. I really do. But that's five spots right there. That would mean one more is left up for grabs in the top six. And MVP ballots, by the way, they go five players deep, but because of the point system and how many different names appear, they come up with a consensus top 10. And SGA currently sits sixth on my own MVP ladder. He's not a short to get it. He's definitely helped by limited availability from, let's say, Steph, Kevin Durant, LeBron James, Kawhi. Any one of them could still technically appear on ballots. I would think that Curry would probably have the best chance of the bunch, maybe Kawhi. Domantas Sabonis, Damian Lillard, and James Harden all hover around the top 10 of the hashtag discourse. Jimmy Butler is definitely going to cannibalize some consideration. Devin Booker and Anthony Davis have probably played just enough to absorb some too. People with long-term memories won't soon forget Donovan Mitchell or John Morant either. Then we have the win-loss purists. They might struggle to consider the best player on a team that is neither guaranteed to finish at or above 500 or in the top of the half of the conference as an MVP candidate. This SGA is not the only player this could impact, but he is the newest entry into that megastar tier, which also might hurt him, and it renders him uniquely vulnerable to oversight. It should not, of course. SGA is averaging over 30 points and five assists while hitting more than 53% of his twos, generating 10 plus free throw attempts per game, and playing the kind of defense that makes you dream big, even if a little recklessly. Even during the era of broken statistical records, this meld of volume and efficiency bends your brain. Prior to this season, Steph Curry, Kevin Durant, and James Harden were the only players to clear 30 points and five assists while matching SGA's current true shooting percentage. dinging Shea for Oklahoma City's record or even his aversion to three-point shooting rings hollow in the MVP discourse. He is still among the toughest covers in the league thanks to the eccentricity of his off-the-dribble cadence. And the Thunder are also winning the minutes with him on the court by more than Dallas wins the minutes with Luka Doncic on the court. Are we going to penalize Shea then for the minutes that he's not on the court? That doesn't necessarily make sense to me. OKC at large is brimming with feel-good stories and developments. It is deep and improving and on the cusp of a higher-end arrival. SGA is still very much the soul of its operation. Among the 450-ish players who have been in at least 15 games this season, only Doncic and Trae Young see more of their baskets go unassisted. Shea, by the way, also continues to hover around the top 10 in clutch win probability added, according to Impredictable. Like every other guesstimate here, SGA's fringe MVP candidacy is not inarguable. And I think it's bold to say they'll finish in the top six. I myself am wondering, though, could he usurp one of Tatum or Doncic? I think it's a fair question. Regardless, his MVP case, fringe MVP case, because we know he's not going to finish in the top three, it exists in airtight supply with the strength necessary and deserving of crashing the back end of the ballot. That'll do it for this episode. But as always, I leave you all first and foremost. Please remember to rate, review, and subscribe if you've not already. If this is your first time checking us out, subscribe on YouTube, certainly, if you've made it this far. Like, comment, help the algorithm love us back. Tell people about us if you've done all those things. Shout outs on Twitter, quote us on Twitter, the whole nine. Join our Discord. The link to that is in the podcast description. Until next time, and as always, we leave you the shout out to one, the only, Frankie Ntilikina, and I offer my sincerest of apologies, like always, to Jeff.